This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's not the best part of America, the part that says, well, I need my car and I need this and I need that. No, you don't. You want those things. And like a child, you confuse your wants with your needs.
Magical thinking. According to the McGraw-Hill Concise Dictionary of Modern Medicine, this is a condition similar to a normal stage of childhood development in which thoughts, words, or actions assume a magical power and are able to prevent or cause events to happen without a physical action occurring. If you think this sounds a little bit like our policy approach to the climate crisis, you're not alone. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Steve Almond, author, social commentator, and a highly opinionated gentleman. Today, in part one of our two-part discussion, he rails against an infantile, narcissistic mindset that allows denial of science and inaction on the environment. Listen now as we jaw about the media response to 9/11, scolding our children, and our inalienable right to big sodas. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by one of my favorite authors, Steve Almond. Steve, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks.
It's great to have you here. I first became aware of your writing from what I imagine was a pretty controversially greeted essay called The Decade of Magical Thinking. First, why don't you tell us the thesis of it and what it was about 9/11 on the 10th anniversary. Give us a little background on your thought process, if you can remember writing this piece, The Decade of Magical Thinking.
Yeah, well, let me say up front that I remember, like everybody else, I remember 9/11 happening. I remember, you know, getting a call. I had a slow internet connection. I had no TV and I didn't really listen to the radio. I was just sitting in an apartment in Somerville writing crappy stories. And, but I'd also been a journalist for a number of years. And part of the reason I'd left journalism was because it was so pervaded by a kind of rat box mentality, by which I mean, it's like when you shake up a box full of rats and then you suddenly open the door and the rats are kind of frantic and confused and they just move towards whatever is bright and shiny. And there's no sustained attention in modern media. It's all a big stimulation game. And when a quote-unquote story like the murder of almost 3,000 American citizens comes along, there is obviously, that's a big deal and it's a big story. But I could, within 5 minutes of turning on the radio and hearing the reports, I could tell that this was going to be essentially this mass marketed story that was going to become the central narrative for the entire country, and that there was going to be a tremendous amount of discussion of the wound and the suffering and the trauma of 3,000 Americans in New York City being killed in this horrific attack. And I'm not trying to minimize how horrific it is, but it struck me in those first 5 minutes, and it struck me 10 years later, that there are a lot of people who die on the planet who are equally human to the people who died in that, you know, in that. And in fact, there are a lot of people who are murdered as well as dying of illness and dying of preventable disease and dying of malnutrition, most of whom are actually children in terms of illness and malnutrition, and that they're also human beings, and that you cannot shake up a box of journalists and open that, you know, and open it up and say, run towards the children in the impoverished parts of the planet who are dying needlessly, because that's a huge, big deal story. It just doesn't work. There's not enough calamity. There's not enough histrionics. And that's a moral issue that's troubling, and it troubled. I'm not suggesting that it wasn't a horrible thing that 3,000 people were murdered. Of course it was. That's the most obvious thing you could say. It's horrible when anybody's murdered. It's horrible when anybody dies, period. If you have a conscience, if you're a person of faith, if you're a person of morality, somebody dying is a great tragedy. What I objected to and what I found so troubling was that this particular episode was appropriated, and the quote-unquote grief and mourning was appropriated by so many people in such an overtly manipulative way, and to push an agenda that was ultimately murderous and destructive to our national conscience and to actual young people in our military and to lots and lots of people who we'll never hear about, who died and are dying overseas as a result of the kind of tribal energy that was roused around that, I repeat, tragic event in which, I repeat, tragically, 3,000 Americans were killed.
Let me read to you a passage from this essay, and let's then loop it back to another crisis, which we're all facing, which is the climate crisis. You write, "Freud and others were fascinated by the concept of infantile omnipotence. This is what a child feels early in his life and what he must eventually surrender when he realizes he does not and cannot control the world. There are some people, though, who can never quite accept this truth. They don't have a strong enough sense of self to sustain the psychic injury, and thus they resort to magical thinking, delusions of grandeur, angry projections, wild superstitions. They become, in this sense, more closely aligned with primitive cultures." Now, let's talk about that magical thinking. And there was a narcissism involved with watching it on TV.
Right.
People who are watching it, this story unfold, and where were you when this happened? Oh, I saw it on TV, or I saw the buildings come down themselves. And then we all shared these stories. And it was a way to kind of feed our self-victimization, as you say. So how does that relate now to trying to enact policy which is rational? And I think when we talk about magical thinking translating into policy, that really translates into stagnation. And stagnation and status quo in these times, really, that can equal doom in a lot of ways.
Well,
I don't know if that's a question, but
here's what a kid does. When a kid doesn't like the reality of what's happening, they deny it or they just close their eyes. That's what they do. Their line between fantasy and reality is blurred. Adults are the people who are supposed to come in and say, actually, the reason you can't run out into the street, the reason that I grabbed you and pulled you back and scolded you, as I had to do with my three-year-old this morning, and he burst into tears, the reason I did that is because you could have been hit by a car, because see, there's a car, it just went by. And if it didn't see you because you're kind of little, or the person was talking on their phone or whatever, then you would be hit and your body would be crushed and killed. And that's a horrible thing to have to acknowledge, but you need to know that that danger exists in the world, or you're going to get killed, and I'm going to be heartbroken, and you'll be dead. That's something that you say to your kids all the time. And you rely on your senses and your adult sense of what reality is. You don't magically say, well, my child won't be killed because my child is my child, and they're lucky, and they're wearing a brightly colored coat, and people are compassionate, and they drive carefully, and all the rest of it. The thing that is crazy-making about the discussion around climate change is we have a whole bunch of adults in charge of the whole thing. They're called scientists. They spend their life trying to figure out, they have devoted their lives trying to figure out what the climate patterns of this country are and this planet are and how they are affected in what direction. They don't have any stake in it. They're just trying to figure out, like every scientist, what's the empirical truth of what's happening around us. And arrayed against them, you don't have any counter-scientists who say, oh, this is just nonsense, greenhouse gases don't exist, all this, the car isn't really there in the road, it's not really speeding by. You have people who are closing their eyes and saying, we're not sure if that really exists, and you know, the planet changes. Like, I put my trust not in ad men or demagogues or corporations who have a clear financial stake in ginning up, you know, fake science. I just put it in the adults in the room who are the scientists. And until the country is made sufficiently aware of that, and it is not a subject that's argued about on cable television, you don't have a clear message to people to make the reality of that apparent. And unfortunately, there is an entire party, I think actually both parties play a role in this. When you say something like, we can become energy independent and we just need to do it through digging up coal and fracking and creating a, you know, Keystone pipeline, it's like a child saying, I can do this. I'm powerful enough. I don't need any help from anybody else. And I don't need to do anything that's inconvenient. I can handle this whole thing. And you have a young kid, at least one. I've got a couple. Kids are constantly doing this. When the reality is too difficult to face and too inconvenient and too morally discomforting, they just close their eyes or they start to think magically. And if it's a little kid, you manage it as best you can as a parent, trying to avoid your kid getting seriously hurt on the playground or in a street or something. When it's the entire planet and it's your species, I think you have to be more insistent about saying, you know what? Magical thinking is going to kill us. This is childish thinking. The denial of what a bunch of scientists have confirmed, the denial of clear facts that are established by rising oceans and melting glaciers and all the rest of it. Nobody made that up. We didn't just have the 10 hottest years of the last 11 years in history because scientists are making it up to get more funding for their projects. That's a child's view of the kind of crisis we're facing.
We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author Steve Almond. So getting back to the climate science denial issue, it seems like the big concession from the right is now, okay, climate change exists, but are we causing it? Is this really progress at all, though, Steve?
It's just not a discussion that's an adult discussion. The adult discussion is, okay, we're going to destroy our habitat if we don't make fundamental changes in the way that we live. We're just going to do that. And the sadistic thing about it, the thing to me that is, you know, when I before I was a parent, I didn't worry about it because people who are in their 30s and 40s and 50s will coast by. We'll just catch the very end of peak oil. We'll keep squeezing the rocks and doing whatever we have to and offloading the environmental ruin to places in the world that we don't have to face. When people die there, it doesn't matter because they're not really fully human to us. They're an abstraction. They're the poor brown people who, in parentheses, in our own entitled first world way, probably deserve to be that way because they were unfortunate enough to not be born Americans. We're going to offload our environmental ruin into those places and continue to suck up their resources and heat up the planet, and we'll be fine. We can do that without inconveniencing ourselves for the next 30 years and probably be okay. Gas will get a little bit more expensive. We won't be able to fly as much, but we'll basically be all right. It's our kids who are sunk. It's our kids who are in real big trouble because the entire basis of our economies and the global economy are founded on demonstrably disappearing resources that have a demonstrably disastrous effect on the habitat that is going to create untold havoc and ruin on the planet. And that's, I just trust scientists who say this, even though it's a difficult thing to look at and it's scary. That's what adults do. That's their job, is to sort of look out for the next generation. Even George Bush, as he had, you know, Cheney ushering into the into the White House, the oil executives who were going to write his environmental laws, said, part of our job is to be good stewards of the planet. Well, how do you do that? You consult with the people whose life work it is to figure out how to continue to make the planet habitable and sustainable, and you see what they say is going to happen, and you act accordingly. You don't engage in a dialogue with children. with people who use magical thinking and childish thinking to essentially protect the moneyed interests that keep them in power. That's not a rational discussion to have.
We talk about childish thinking, and a child tends to think that the world revolves around them. And you wrote a piece last week called, and it's on therumpus.net, where you write frequently. You have an ongoing column called The Week in Greed. This is The Week in Greed number 14, and the title is My Job is Not to Worry About Those People. I don't want to necessarily focus on the piece, which is brilliant, but the first commenter, a woman named Virginia, who seemed to take this very personally. One of the subsequent commenters said, I was trying to figure out why Virginia took this article as such a personal assault, as though it was written specifically with her in mind. There seems to be a very strange sort of narcissism going on there. And that kind of brings me back to your magical thinking essay, where people were looking at the Twin Towers coming down, and it was not about how we reacted. The most important thing was our feelings. How did we feel? And our reaction, many would say, was quite childish. And that's similar to what we would feel when I don't want to be stripped of my God-given right to drive the biggest damn SUV I can. I can afford it, so why can't I do that? It makes me feel good, and let the rest of the people figure it out. That's not my job.
Well, part of the problem is that nobody likes to be told how to behave, and nobody likes to be told that they're in the wrong. But the problem is, and I struggle with this because I am just as American as everybody else. I mean, the problem with the left is that they say, but I drive a Prius and I recycle, so I'm actually okay. It's like, look, we're all engaged in an unsustainable arrangement. And I think, honestly, the only way that's going to change is if we start to run out of the resources that feed our convenience and start to learn how to do things that 100 years ago and 200 years ago and 500 years ago people knew how to do, like farming their own land and creating local economies that weren't run through giant corporations. This is ultimately the only way the community really works, is if you really depend on one another, not if it's discretionary and you try to create it artificially. And there is a way in which I sort of look ahead and say, well, gee, if the internet got turned off and all our screens got turned off and everybody had to really deal with one another and everybody had to take public transportation, all the classes had to do that, the world would probably be a more patient and less scattered and less delusional place. I don't know how that's going to happen, but I have a feeling there's going to be some bloodshed involved. In other words, if people can't bring themselves to change their lifestyles voluntarily, to give up convenience, to give up the privileges of a kind of unsustainable first world life, then it's going to be imposed on their children and grandchildren. And that's just the way, I mean, I hate to say this, it disturbs me, it disturbs my wife especially when I say this, but those are the facts on the ground. We get the leadership that we deserve. You know, Obama has been a less flagrantly awful leader in terms of environmental stuff. But look, when you know, part of the job of politicians is to make tough decisions that the public doesn't want and might not be ready for. Something like, oh, abolishing slavery, for instance, okay, or allowing women to have the vote, or any of the other signs of clear moral progress that we've made as a country when called upon, when it was necessary, when somebody stepped up and said, I'm going to truly make an inconvenient decision, but it's for the moral good and the practical good of our people. It is unconscionable that right-thinking liberals or anybody who's an adult hasn't demanded that we just simply say, look, every big city has to have public transportation. That's the only way to make our city life sustainable and to make sure that we don't wind up subject to attacks like 9/11. That is something that has to be demanded by the population of its leaders. And Obama, you know, again, I'm working for his reelection. I think he's got the right ideas and so forth. But it is sad to me that he has been so timid about listening to the scientists who tell us about the things that we can do that cause minor inconvenience so that down the road we don't have major upheaval and major planetary ruin, or that we mitigate the ruin that unfortunately we know is coming to some extent because of the actions that we've taken and continue to take, mostly in the first world, but all over the planet now, that are unsustainable.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author Steve Almond. You make a very rational case for what Obama should do in your previous The Week in Greed. It was the speech that Obama won't give. And you kind of lay out the Steve Almond plan for the green economy, and there were a couple bullet points that shouted out at me, and then you said Obama should just get up there and say he will construct public transportation systems in all major American cities. He will quintuple our investment in renewable energy technologies, including job retraining and workers in unsustainable energy sectors. These all sound like complete no-brainers, but why are these politically unfeasible issues?
Well, Americans have a cult of the automobile, they have a cult of the highway, they have a cult of sort of phony self-reliance, but most of all, they have a cult of convenience. And, you know, I struggle with this every day. Tomorrow I'm going to go off on a plane, which I know is the worst thing I can do, but it's part of what I do for my job. I try to make sure that I do as much as I can when I'm on the road. But, you know, I have to get up at 6 in the morning. And my wife always says, take a cab. And I always say, no, I'm dragging my suitcase at 6 in the morning up to the local public transportation and taking public transportation, even though I hate doing it and it's a drag. I do it because I feel so guilty, because I know basically that I'm a jerk and a hypocrite for taking a plane. I don't know how to mitigate it. I try to do it in as much as I can, but ultimately that's my bad. And I guess what I'm trying to suggest in that is, the central thing that people have to do if they say they're really concerned about the environment is start to think about the things that they do, the conveniences they enjoy, that they need to enjoy less. You know, we had two cars that were old, you know, little Tercel and a Civic. My Tercel finally, broke down, and we just said, okay, we're getting rid of that. We're down to one car. That means we do more walking. To the extent that I can, in everyday ways that drive my wife crazy, I am saying, look, we shouldn't go to Target, period, because of their politics and of the big box store, you know, sort of profligacy that we all consent to because it's convenient. And we especially shouldn't get more, you know, plastic containers there, produced probably somewhere in the third world, so we don't have to pay attention. They're cheap. We love it. We cling on to the golden arrow of consumption, but we ignore the environmental ruin of how the resources were extracted and who actually did the extracting and how that stuff got made and where and what was the runoff from the factory. We just ignore all that stuff. And I'm saying to her, look, honey, every day we go to a supermarket, a palace of plenitude, and we bring yogurt and other plastic containers into this house. All we have to do is run them through the dishwasher, and they are the same as those Glad produced convenient little, you know, plastic containers that we have to buy. We gotta make this conversion to not having those in the house, not driving to Target to get them. We're a part of the problem until we do that. And frankly, if I was king and boss and whatever else, I would say, well, gee, can't we incentivize people making their land economically productive? Can't we incentivize local economies where people trade stuff okay, you grow Anaheim peppers and Chipotle peppers. I grow tomatoes. And over here, this person grows herbs. And, oh, you make mustard. And this is the kind of thing that is not going to happen unless you're, you know, to the general population, it's not going to happen until you create an economic incentive for it. Until you say to restaurants and supermarkets, hey, can you have a giant bin? And for anybody who brings in their own plastic container to be filled with whatever it is, we'll give you a tax rebate if you set up a more sustainable grocery market.
Next week in San Francisco, for example, we're instituting a 10-cent fee for anybody who doesn't bring their own bag to a grocery
store. Fantastic.
And people have been kind of apologizing about it. And I'm saying, this is great, actually. I mean, because there's real evidence that it works. In Ireland, they instituted, I think, a 5-cent ban, and it eliminated plastic bag use by 93%. I mean, this is right. It's a tiny little tax, but it makes people conscious.
What I love about like stuff like, oh, they're banning big sodas in, you know, in New York City. Where? Like this is some kind of assault on your self-reliance. Like, shut up and have a smaller drink, you fatso. Like, come on. Well, it's like the sense of American entitlement. There's such a fundamental confusion between the luxuries we enjoy and the rights that rightfully should be preserved. And giant supersized sodas does not count in the inalienable rights that we're endowed with by our creator. It's such a joke that this kind of entitlement psychosis has so taken over Americans. And like, we're people who complain because the line is too long in the ice cream store. And I'm sitting there going, I'm sorry, like there's half the world that goes to sleep hungry and doesn't even know what ice cream is and would just like some more gruel that's made out of cornmeal that they're, you know, that's given to them in a feculent refugee camp. Can we just stop being such spoiled brats for 5 minutes and remember that we have a conscience? I mean, it's not the best part of America, the part that says, well, I need my car and I need this and I need that. No, you don't. You want those things. And like a child, you confuse your wants with your needs.
Author Steve Almond, his latest book is a collection of stories called God Bless America. People can also read him at therumpus.net. Steve, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, it was a pleasure to be on Sea Change.
Tune in to Sea Change Radio next week to hear the second part of my discussion with Steve Almond.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by King Sunny Ade, Gil Scott Heron, and Bonorama.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.